Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on March 5th, so please go ahead and mark your calendars. March 5th is our next Practitioners Forum. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls are going to work, or they typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants that we have on today, we ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. I will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you entered it while logging on, and that you have a question. That's if you want to come in live and ask your question live with us, but you also have the option of typing in your question. I've already see here that several of you have already submitted your questions ahead of time, which lets me know that you're paying attention in previous events. So please go ahead and continue to do that. Submit your questions now. I will put you in the queue and hopefully get them answered before the end of the day or the end of this call. All right, now that brings me to my next point. For these practitioners forum calls, the VIP members receive priority. So for those of you who submitted questions ahead of time via email, if you are a TRI VIP member, you are at the top of the list, so we make sure that your questions get asked and answered by our professionals. So now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin with today's call. Joining us today is the head of our legal department, Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13 debtor and creditor representation while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. So, ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to visit our website at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org. Regularly, as the offers change each time, get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. And on the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, and appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our courses at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we are here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much. Emphasis on teaching you how to make more money. All right, guys, so let's go ahead and get started with our questions here. Again, VIP members get priority, so this first round of questions is coming directly from TRI VIP members. Hang tight, because during the middle of the forum, I will share with you how to become a TRI member. First one is coming from James, and James is asking, thanks for the wonderful effort you do relative to this activity. I'd like to get some clarification regarding the dischargeability of taxes and bankruptcy. Could you please clarify the 3-year, 2-year, and 240-day rules? Does that imply a taxpayer cannot file for BK before or after any such dates lapse, and how is it calculated? And he provides an example. He says, a taxpayer has a large debt with the IRS since 2010 and lost his appeal with court. Can he file now for BK after almost 7 years with over 250K taxes, interest, and penalty?
Okay, so James, it doesn't say here what your title is. I imagine it's a CPA or an EA, unless you're an attorney. Obviously, you can't represent a taxpayer in bankruptcy court. So really, you need just enough information to know that some taxes are dischargeable in bankruptcy under certain circumstances. And there's rules involved that determine whether or not a tax year is dischargeable. And if you think that the taxpayer may benefit from a bankruptcy, then your sole job is to tell the taxpayer to seek bankruptcy counsel, not to advise them on filing or not filing a bankruptcy, the timing of the bankruptcy, the chapter of the bankruptcy, where or when to file the bankruptcy, only to seek advice from a qualified bankruptcy attorney. And if taxes are involved, you want to go even one more step and say that the taxpayer should seek a bankruptcy attorney who's familiar with discharging taxes, because most bankruptcy attorneys aren't. They're more involved in credit cards and that kind of debt, consumer debt, as opposed to tax debt, which is non-consumer bankruptcy debt. The three-year rule says that the bankruptcy has to be filed more than 3 years after the due date of the return, not when the return was filed. The only date that's relevant for the three-year rule is the date that the return was due, even if it wasn't filed. So, like, for instance, the due date of the 2018 return is either April 15, thereabouts, of 2019, or if it's on extension, then October 15 or thereabout, 2019. And I say thereabout because sometimes the 15th falls on a weekend, sometimes it's a holiday, and so it could be due, you know, the 17th or the 18th under certain situations, but it's the middle of the month. So if the taxpayer, for instance, owes for the 2018 return, then it's 3 years from 2019. So it's going to be sometime in 2022, either after mid-April or after mid-October. The two-year rule means that it has to be more than 2 years after the return was actually filed. And that really only kicks in if the return is filed more than a year after its due date. Because if it's filed on its due date, then it's going to automatically, obviously, meet the two-year rule along with the three-year rule. But if it was filed late or it's an amended return, then it may be beyond the 3 years of the three-year rule. And the 240-day rule means that the tax has to have been assessed by the taxing agency more than 240 days before the bankruptcy. So if that was an audit or an amended return, or not when the return was filed, but when the tax was actually assessed. So the 240 days has to do with the assessment date. But again, you're not going to be involved in the minutia. Your job is simply to let the taxpayer know that bankruptcy may be an option and that you seek bankruptcy advice.
All right, Norman, thank you very much, James, and hopefully that answers your question there. Moving on to the next VIP member, this is Ann. Ann is asking, I have a new client that came to me with a copy of his 2015 1040 tax return, his signed 8879, including prior CPA signature, and a letter from the CPA stating that the return was being e-filed. He also has a letter from the IRS stating that the 2015 1040 return was never filed, and what should they do with the money on his account for this period? He actually owed a little more money with the return. What is the best response, and is he responsible for any failure to file penalty since he had reason to believe it was filed? The prior CPA is not responding to his calls, so unable to get any proof of submission. He is also slow to return his original paperwork to the client for 2016 and 17, and we need to get those returns filed now.
Okay, so what he should do at this point is go ahead and file, paper file, the 2015 return, and I would send it in certified mail, and you might, if they're saying no return was filed, you still may want to put on top of the return possible duplicate, because it may have been e-filed and it just got lost somewhere or something. And it's really confusing if the IRS gets two returns. So you might just want to say possible duplicate return. But definitely send it certified. Now, as to the failure to file penalty, they have grounds for penalty abatement under reasonable cause. And the thinking is this, is that they have a letter from their CPA stating that the return was e-filed. And so they believe that the return was filed. When they received the letter from the IRS saying that the return was not filed, they, as soon as possible, filed a paper return. And so they're asking that the penalty be abated as to reasonable cause, because they reasonably relied on representation of their tax preparer, CPA, that the return was being e-filed. But let me just say that the case law on this is not good, is where under other circumstances, if a return is filed late and it's the CPA's fault, you can usually get the penalty abated. But for some reason, when it comes to e-filing, they're a little bit behind the times. So I have a case now that's pending where I'm disputing a late filing penalty because of this exact issue. And there is some they're called friend of the court briefs, where there are briefs that are filed in tax court cases, but they're not filed by either the IRS or the taxpayer, but by third parties who for some reason may have a stake in the outcome. And so there's like friend of the court briefs that have been filed by like a CPA organization or something supporting the taxpayers and saying that that the penalty should be abated. And remember, even if you don't succeed on the abatement of the penalty through reasonable cause, you may be able to abate the penalty under the first time penalty abatement program. So always try reasonable cause first, because you don't want to use up your first time penalty abatement. Is just that, it's a one time thing, first time. And so you kind of want to save that as a wild card. So I would try reasonable cause first, and if that doesn't succeed, then try first-time penalty abatement.
All right, Ann, I noticed you also sent in a second question. I'll see if we can get to that second question here a little bit further down the call. Moving on to our next member, this is Angie. Angie is asking, I sat with a friend during her appeal with the IRS in the Baltimore office. She is an insurance agent in a multi-level marketing operation. She is a Schedule C filer, and her husband has W-2 and also joined the MLM in 2013, 14, and 15. These were the years that were selected for audit, and the examiner disallowed many claims, stating that they were personal. This brought her to appeals, and she has also petitioned the court. Now, I reviewed many of her expenses and receipts and believe they are legitimate. I understand the nature of the business and the type of claims geared towards promoting the products and recruiting other agents. Some of them, the IRS is saying, is not reasonable and ordinary. An example, travel to convention and rewards paid to her downline is required by her contract. IRS claims they are not her employees. This appeals agent was using language and scare tactics to threaten my friend, saying things like fraud and slamming his hand on the table and raising his voice. I agree that her bookkeeping was not the best, as she used her personal credit cards and bank account to manage her business. So he is saying there's a pattern in overall sloppiness that is hurting her credibility. Do you think that credibility alone is enough for the IRS to throw out other well-supported expenses? He just didn't want to hear anything else and told her the judge won't want to hear it either. He offered her 10% discount off the liability to settle so he can close the case. She refused and will be heading to court. Do you think she stands a chance? He cited the Garza and De Lima cases.
Yeah, but I guess picking odds right now doesn't really matter because she's already kind of rolled the dice and going to court. The thing is, what Garza and De Lima cases represent is kind of an all or nothing thing, where they said, like in the Garza case, where it has to do with travel expenses and the taxpayer's truck, is either you have sufficient documentation to support your expenses or you don't. And in fact, it doesn't even go to credibility because, for instance, in Garza, the judge said, you know, I believe what you're telling me, and I believe that you used your truck for a business. But unless you have sufficient documentation to support it, I can't allow the expenses. So if they're kind of switching it around and saying, well, your documentation is sufficient, but I don't believe you, and I think that that's that takes Garza and De Lima and turns those cases on its heads. So I think she's got a good chance if her documentation is sufficient to prevail, because that's what's really required is the documentation. And I'm not sure who they're dealing with, the IRS, whether it's an appeals officer or IRS counsel representing IRS in tax court or whatever. But first of all, there may be a settlement required, like a mandatory settlement conference before trial. And secondly, there may be other ways to settle before trial. But if it does go to trial, if her documentation is sufficient, she should prevail. And it's really not a question of was it necessary so much as it's a question of can she substantiate the expenses, which it seems like you're saying she can. So I think she's got a good chance.
All right, Angie, there you go. Hopefully that provides you some guidance there. Moving on to our next VIP member, this is Rajendra. Rajendra is an EA. He's asking on 433, where do I show the fee paid or to be paid to a practitioner for the resolution work to calculate the RCP?
So I think I'd put it under miscellaneous or other expenses. So the way you want to do it, though, is I'm not sure how you're doing it, but let's say you're charging them a couple thousand dollars or $5,000 to do the offer, and they're paying you $50 a month or something. So in the expenses, you'd show $50 a month going towards professional fees for the offer. I think what you might want to substantiate that expense would be some kind of engagement letter or retainer agreement to show that they've agreed to pay you X amount of dollars to represent them in the offer, and then either cancel checks or the bank statements or something to show that they're making monthly payments to pay off that amount. And yes, those monthly payments are allowed, but remember, those monthly payments aren't going to go on forever. And so one of the calculations they're going to do on the offer is how much has that monthly payment towards professional services for the offer, and when will those services be paid off in full, and then the taxpayer will have that much more disposable income going forward. So if given a choice for a payment plan, you'd probably want a lower monthly payment over a longer period of time than a higher payment over a shorter period of time, because if it's over a certain amount of time, then they'll just let it go. But if it's over a short period of time, then they're going to calculate the additional disposable income down the line, and it might not work in your favor. But the short answer is yes, they do allow payments for professional services, and you'd probably put it under miscellaneous or other expenses, and then you would clarify what it is.
Now, Rajendra, just to add to that, most resolution cases or people that have resolution problems are a transactional case for you. So it's a one-time event. So this is an opportunity for practitioners to be able to turn these into longer clients. So look for an opportunity to make them your tax and accounting clients so that they have ongoing expense to you. And the longer that expense you can prove, the longer the IRS will allow it and not do as Norman suggested here and cutting it off at some point. So think about that. And for the long term, yeah, these people are at your door for this one specific problem. Look for the opportunity to do their taxes, to do their accounting work, to be able to grow your practice. All right, moving on to Tom. Tom is also a member and he's an EA. He's asking, husband and wife clients have joint tax liability due to the husband's self-employment status. If he files for BK, will the IRS go after her W-2 wages to recover the taxes?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. I don't know what state they're in, but for instance, in California, because it's a community property state, they would have to list, even if only one of the spouses was filing bankruptcy, they'd have to list the other spouse's liabilities as well, income and expenses, because it's all community property. But the short answer is yes. If only one files for bankruptcy, then that debt is discharged as to him, but not to the non-filing spouse. And the IRS could go after the other spouse for the full amount of the taxes, by the way, not just half or their share or something, but the total amount of taxes. So it really doesn't make much sense to file for only one of them to file bankruptcy. Usually we say they both should, because what's the purpose otherwise? They're just going to go after the non-filing spouse.
All right, moving on to Neela. Neela is a CPA and also a VIP member. Can you discuss the most common tolling events when calculating the end of the 10-year statute? I have a client who I think has passed the collection statute, but the IRS just sent in a garnishment order to his employer. Do you recommend software to do this? How accurate are they?
I mean, we have software that does it, and I think it's pretty good, but I always like to double check it. And so you want to order account transcripts, and you want to look at the transcript, and you want to see if there's any tolling events on the transcript. Typical tolling events are anything that would stop the IRS collection process. So for instance, submitting an offer in compromise stops the clock because it's tolled from the time that the offer is submitted to either when the offer is rejected or withdrawn. If it's accepted, it doesn't matter because then the tax is compromised. But if the offer's rejected, for instance, then it's for the time that it was submitted to when it was rejected, plus 30 days because you have a 30 days period in which you can appeal it. And if you appeal it, then it's still tolled for longer. Bankruptcy tolls the 10-year statute. Living outside the country for more than 6 months tolls the statute. The time between submitting a request for an installment agreement and to the time that the installment agreement is either accepted or rejected plus 30 days tolls the statute. The time that you're in the installment agreement does not toll the statute, but the time that the request for an installment agreement is pending does toll the statute because they can't collect while an installment agreement request is pending. I mean, you could call, if they receive some kind of notice of intent to levy or a garnishment order, I would call the IRS on the number on that garnishment order and ask them why that tax year isn't beyond collection, and they may be able to tell you what it was that told it and when it would become uncollectible. But I would do that. I would order transcript. I'm not sure why they're levying if you believe that the statute is expired. There must have been some tolling, and I would find out why.
All right, Neela, hopefully that answers your question. If not, use some of that consultation time. Give us a call. We'll be happy to go over it with you one more time. Next question here is from Mildred. Mildred is a CPA, also a VIP member, and is asking, I have a client who is on uncollectible status since last April. Since almost a year will have passed, I believe that the IRS will begin collection proceedings soon. Client is working on a month-to-month contract and being paid on a W-2. Client owes taxes for several years dating back to 2007. Taxes and penalties outstanding total about $60,000. Statute of limitation on the earlier years will expire soon. Before I prepare an OIC, are there any suggestions as to how I can delay things so as to allow the statute to take effect? Client was out of work for a couple of years until mid-2016 and staying with various friends, sometimes paying minimal rent and catching up with expenses from past few years.
Okay, so first of all, uncollectible status or the full term is currently non-collectible, is a temporary status, and that's why it's currently non-collectible as opposed to permanently non-collectible, which I don't believe exists. So, but currently non-collectible can be up to 2 years. So when you say that they've been in currently non-collectible since last April, so it's been less than a year, and you say that you believe it's going to go to collection soon, but that's not necessarily true. It may not go back to collections for another year. Or if he's a W-2 employee now and his circumstances have changed since a year ago when he was put into currently non-collectible, when he files his 2018 return, if they see, you know, that there's a large increase in income from his 2017 return, that may kick it out. So you may want to think about filing an extension and not filing his 2018 return until October if his 2018 return is going to show significantly more income than 2017 did. The other thing is you could, what happens when you're no longer in currently non-collectible is they ask for updated financial, like a 433F. So you could submit another 433F, a current one, and maybe qualifies for either continuing being and currently non-collectible, or maybe a small installment agreement. Also, if he owes about $60,000, he may qualify for an extended streamline installment agreement if he can afford it, which would be the $60,000 divided by 84 months, or other things. So there are other things you want to do. I guess you want you don't want to submit the OIC until the earlier years are no longer collectible. And again, OIC tolls the statute. So if you're getting towards the end, you don't want to file an OIC now and stop the clock. But 2007 would have been filed, if filed timely, in 2008 and assessed in 2008. And so the statute should have expired in 2018, unless there was some kind of tolling event. So 2007 may have already met the statute, and 2008 may be coming up if it was filed, let's say, in April 2009, and it might have been assessed in May or June of 9. And it may be the statute may expire in May or June of 2019. But don't necessarily believe that he's going to be out of currently non-collectible soon. It may be another year. And if you're concerned about the 2018 return, kicking it out of CNC, then you may want to file an extension and file that bet in October. And that's basically my advice on buying some time.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to our last VIP member question here. Anne, I promised you I circled back, and here we are. So Anne is asking, I have a new client who told the IRS last summer that his business would be having employees in payroll. He has not processed any payroll yet, has not filed any payroll forms. Is it possible to change the start date on his payroll processing or in any way reduce the penalties for not filing 941 and 940 reports? Should we just file all the zero returns now? He has no hardship issues, just didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah, right. So the penalty is based on the tax. So if you file zero returns, there's zero penalty if you don't owe any tax. So I would go ahead and file zero returns for every quarter now until he starts getting employees, and then filing the returns based on his employee compensation. But yeah, go ahead and file the zero returns. Right, when you get your EIN, they ask you, when do you anticipate starting employees? And so that's just a guess. It may be later, but that's already water under the bridge. I think filing zero return is the easiest way of dealing with that problem.
All right, and there you go. And as I mentioned to you before, these questions for the practitioners forum that do take priority come from VIP memberships. And Jose, you asked online now, how do you become a member? Well, here's my quick pitch to everyone on here. If you've attended these events before, you know that I always try to encourage people to sign up, and I throw an extra freebie on there. So what we're doing is, for the Ultimate Membership Package, we're offering you a 2-month free trial. So just sign up for the trial, give it a spin, see all the benefits that you get from becoming a VIP member, including priority on these practitioners forum calls. And there's nothing out of pocket. It's free for 2 months. Thereafter, it's $90 a month. I'm going to push a link, but just so you know what you get with the Ultimate Membership Package, you do get some consultation with a CPA or tax attorney that deals with resolution or specializes in resolution and other tax matters. You get free access to videos on demand. You get access to our comprehensive library, which includes a lot of white papers to help you with your acquiring of knowledge on resolution matters. So installment agreements, offers and compromise, how to process an appeal, penalty abatement, innocent spouse. There's just a vast array of different white papers that can help guide you. You also get e-learning courses and free webinars. So whenever we have a webinar, usually anywhere between $60 to $100 for the webinar, depending on the length, you get to view them for free as a VIP member. The e-learning courses are self-study guides where you go online, take the courses online, watch a video, answer some questions, and acquire, again, that knowledge that you're seeking for. Plus, you get discounts on our professional system, which is an all-inclusive kit to help you from beginning to end. And what I mean by that is learning how to sell your services, how to market your services, and then, again, how to actually do the work itself. You do get discounts on that. So, I'm going to be pushing the link now. Go ahead and sign up for this free 2-month trial, and then that way we can get on to the remaining section of the questions here. We did have a lot of people submit questions, so I want to make sure that we allow plenty of time for all of them and also address the ones that have been submitting online. So let's move on, Norman, here to the next one. This is coming from Jared. Jared is an attorney, and he has a 2-part question here. So first, he's asking, in calculating an offer and compromise, a taxpayer needs thousands in dental work and has a quote from the oral surgeon as to the cost. Will the IRS permit those costs to be factored into the OIC financial analysis, even though the dental work is not yet scheduled and the taxpayer isn't sure when the work will be done? So I'll let you answer that first before we go on to the second one.
So it's just like the one that we talked about on the professional fees. Is unfortunately, if the dental work is not yet scheduled, then no, they're not going to allow it just based on, oh, he's thinking about getting the work done. What you need is he needs to get the work done and have some kind of payment plan with the dentist and be able to show the IRS that he's making regular monthly payments for this dental work. And the thing is, with dental work and other medical expenses, is there's really no limit to what the IRS will allow for medical expenses. There's no standard. There is a standard for out of pocket, and that's with no substantiation. But if it's going to be greater than out of pocket standard, you have to have proof of the payments. And proof of the payments would be either, one, some kind of statement or agreement or bill or something showing the full amount of the cost of the dental work, and then something showing that the taxpayer's making regular monthly payments for that work, and they'll allow that as a regular monthly expense, but only if it's an actual expense that's being paid, not an expense that is going to happen sometime in the future when the taxpayer decides to have the medical work done.
Right. Remember that there's a look back period that we're considering here, not a future period. It's a look back period for expenses that have already occurred. Okay, Jared, moving on to the second portion of your question here. For a taxpayer with minimal assets and income, what is the most direct number to call to discuss a currently non-collectible status with someone with the IRS? Also, if the taxpayer is getting up there in years and has health challenges, say in the mid-60s, can you argue the taxpayer's 401k should be exempt from financial calculations since other than SS, that is the only money the taxpayer will have to live on in old age?
Okay, so two questions. One is the best number to call. Since you're an attorney, I would suggest that you call the practitioner priority line. And believe it or not, I call it almost every day, and I Google it every time I call. I don't remember what it is. And so just Google IRS practitioner priority line, and you'll get it's an 800 number, and you'll call it, and they'll ask if it's for business or person, and you'll get somebody, and then just tell them what you want to do. Is I guess you want to get somebody put into currently non-collectible status, so you want to have a 433F prepared. And if there's any income or expenses that are out of the ordinary, you might want proof. But otherwise, you definitely want to have the 433F. They may ask you to fax it to them, or they may just go over with the phone with you line by line where you do income and expenses. And they can determine then whether they qualify for CNC or not. Now, the second question is about the taxpayer's 401k. And the answer is yes, if he needs the 401k to live on, then yeah, they're not going to ask him to borrow against it or to liquidate it. But for currently non-collectible, you're going to have to show that even with monthly distributions or whatever, that he just has enough to make all his expenses and there's nothing left over. Because remember, the IRS will accept payments as low as, I think, $25 a month. So the taxpayer has to have less than $25 a month disposable income to qualify for currently non-collectible. Otherwise, they'll put him into a payment plan for as little as $25 a month. And also remember, you don't want a 433F or any financial to show that the taxpayer is upside down, because that's not feasible, and it's not believable on how a taxpayer survives when his expenses exceed his income month after month. So you really want to have income and expenses either equal to each other or very little income over expenses.
Okay, thank you very much, Jared. Hopefully that answers your question there. I do see that you also submitted one online. We'll try to get those at the end of the day, at the end of the call here. So moving on to Ron. Ron is an EA. A married couple has been living abroad for approximately 6 years but maintain their U.S. citizenship. They have investment properties in California and file returns every year. Last year, they sold their home and had a big capital gain. What do I need to do to arrange a payment plan for them? What standards do I use?
Okay, so I don't know how big the capital gain is or how much tax they owe. The easiest way is if you could put them in a streamline. So there's two kinds of streamline. The normal streamline is if they owe under $50,000. An extended streamline is if they owe between $50,000 and $100,000. So if they owe below $50,000, you divide the amount that they owe by 72 months. And if they owe between 50 and 100, you divide it by 84 months. And that will come up with a monthly payment. If they can meet that, then you could probably put them in a streamline installment agreement. If they don't, then you're going to have to complete a 433F. Again, I don't know how much they owe. If they owe more than 250, it may be assigned to an international revenue officer who will want a 433A. And it gets really tricky about, you have to convert everything into dollars. So even if their expenses are in some other currency because they're living abroad, you have to convert it all to dollars. And hopefully they'll meet all the standards. Again, I don't know how much they owe and whether or not you can deal with an international revenue officer or not, which we have a few cases dealing with international revenue officer, and they're more savvy into being able to figure out disposable income. But if you call ACS, they don't have a clue. And they're they even may go by California's standards because they have, I guess their nexus to the United States is California. I guess they're filing a 540 NR non-resident return because they have property in California. Yeah, you can do it, but you need to convert all the expenses into dollars and go from there.
All right, moving on to Edward. Edward is a CPA. He's asking, if an OIC is denied and an appeal is filed and the appeals officer also denies the OIC, can the appeals officer's decision be appealed in tax court?
The answer is yes, but you have a very limited amount of time, like 30 days. And so when the appeals officer denied the OIC, they sent a letter denying it. And that letter gives you the information on how to appeal that. Now, I don't know the grounds for denying the OIC or the grounds for the appeal, but remember that an offer or an installment agreement is not mandatory that the IRS allow it. It's discretionary, and it depends on things like the taxpayer's current compliance and their ability to pay and other factors. And if you're going to appeal it in tax court, the standard that the tax court's going to look at is, did the revenue officer and or the appeals officer abuse their discretion? So it's a very high standard. They have to, you know, they're not going to double think what the appeals officer said, or second guess the appeals officer, unless the appeals officer clearly abused their discretion and for some reason had some animosity or something against the taxpayer and didn't follow strict IRS protocol, the chances of winning in tax court is pretty slim. So I'd have to know the reason for the denial and the reason for the appeal in the taxpayer's position. But unless the appeals officer abused their discretion, which is a very high standard, then the appeals officer's decision will stand.
Okay, thank you very much, Edward. Moving on to Dimitro. Dimitro is asking, I am preparing 433 and 656 for a client who has common law marriage, not legally married, and two kids. Wife makes a lot of money and pays most of the bills and claims the kids. He pays some bills and his personal expenses. They have a joint account where both of them transfer money to pay for mortgage, no equity. 433 AOIC says to include income of everyone who contributes to a household, including significant other, etc. Can I just go by what he makes, or I need to include her income as well? What if she does not want to share or get involved?
Okay, so I don't know what state they're in. Like, for instance, California doesn't recognize common law marriage. So I don't know what state they're in. But when you say not legally married, but that's what a common law marriage is. A common law marriage is legal in that state, even though they've never had a ceremony or whatever, based on whatever the terms are in that state to be determined to be common law marriage. So if you say that, you can't say that they have a common law marriage and they're not legally married, because those are conflicting terms. If they have a common law marriage, they are legally married, but it's under common law marriage. And so in that case, first of all, any joint account is considered income for both of them. So that any money in the joint account is accessible to the taxpayer, would need to be figured in the OIC. And I think that you would have to include the other spouses, we'll call it the non-filing spouses' income, because the husband or the filing spouse is relying on the non-filing spouse's income to make ends meet. So I think you would need to include it.
All right, Dimitro, that goes answer that. I'm going to address some of those questions online, Norman, and let's start at the top here for Martin. Martin's asking, if my client has received a 90-day letter demanding payment and we have submitted Form 933, I think you mean 433, to indicate there is very little money and also they are in bankruptcy, what further steps can I do to help resolve this situation?
Okay, so I'm not sure what notice that is. It's an IRS notice, because usually when we think of 90-day notice, we think of the 90-day letter, audit, which is notice of deficiency, which goes which gives a taxpayer 90 days to file a petition in U.S. tax court. So if that's what you're saying, and you're saying that the taxpayer has little or no disposable income to pay it, and you're also saying that they're in bankruptcy, but the bankruptcy might be an issue, because if this is a notice of deficiency and the deficiency was assessed post-bankruptcy, then that's a post-bankruptcy assessment, and it's treated differently than taxes that were owed pre-bankruptcy. So first of all, I would show this to the taxpayer's bankruptcy attorney to see, I don't know if they're in a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13, that would matter. And I don't know if they listed that liability in their bankruptcy or not, if they knew that they were being audited or whatever. It might have been listed as a contingent debt. But you don't want to waive the 90 days. So you might want to go ahead and file a petition in tax court if you disagree with the assessment, or if it's an issue of just they agree with the assessment but they don't have the ability to pay, then yeah, they could work out some kind of payment plan. But again, depending on the bankruptcy issue, it may be something that may be put into the bankruptcy. For instance, if they're in a 13, it might be treated as an administrative claim, which is a priority claim in the Chapter 13, and they can pay it in the Chapter 13. So there's really not enough information when you start talking about bankruptcy and stuff for me to tell you what to do, especially when I'm not sure what notice they received and what it is that you're seeking to do.
Right, Martin. So if you're not a member, consider signing up for the VIP trial and give us a call. We'll schedule a consultation with Norman to dive into this a little bit further for you. Moving on to the next question online. This is from Dana. Dana's asking, will TRI have a convention this year? Just so you know, we're scouting locations now, and we do plan on having one towards the November-ish date is what we're looking for. But an announcement will be made as soon as we've set a location and a date. So just keep an eye out for those that information.
After tax season.
Definitely after tax season, yes. Jared, here's his follow-up question. Is it your experience that many taxpayers seeking bankruptcy protection have not timely filed their tax returns, so that the practitioner really needs to follow the two-year rule closely, because you will be dealing with unfiled or late filed returns?
No, I would say mostly it's a three-year rule and a 240-day rule, and there's a slight difference between these rules. And the thing is, the three-year rule and the 240-day rule go to priority under Bankruptcy Code Section 507. So priority debts are not dischargeable in a 7 and need to be paid in full in a 13. And so that goes to priority of the debt. The 2-year rule is under Bankruptcy Code Section 523, and that's exceptions to discharge. That's where a discharge discharges all debts except for these exceptions under 523, and that's where the 2-year rule comes in. So 2-year rule is a little bit different, and it's not it doesn't come into play as often as the 3-year rule and the 240-day rule does. And it doesn't have the same strength.
Got it. All right, now moving on to the next questions here. A lot of the questions that you folks are submitting are tax-related questions. So I've gone ahead and asked some of our tax experts related to these questions. So next one is coming from Karen. And it deals with the 199A rules. She says, what are the rules regarding the 199A deduction for rentals? As many of you know, with the new Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the 199A QBI deduction is a big topic, and it still remains to be ambiguous when it comes to rental properties. But the gist of it is that the determining factor, if you qualify for this deduction, is if you can prove that the taxpayer is operating a real estate business and is spending substantial amount of time in the business. So that's really what determines whether or not you can take the QBI deduction. But again, there are ambiguous rules about that. And please use some of this consultation time. I'll schedule a time with one of our tax professionals that are dealing with this as we begin this tax season. Next question is from Carlos. Carlos is asking, can corrected 2017 Form 1099 miscellaneous be submitted electronically? And the answer is yes. You can submit corrected 1099s electronically. It is possible. We submit them using software. Many of you may have heard of the software. CFS is what we use to be able to process our 1099s and also file the corrected 1099s. It is a very specific process to get these corrected 1099s filed electronically. So if you don't use software, I strongly recommend you find a provider, and again, we use CFS, but I'm sure there are others out there. And if you are using software, I double check with those providers to help guide you when it comes to that. All right, moving on to next question here from Mike, who is online. He's asking, I have a client that missed the audit and now is assessed additional tax. It has been over a year since the audit was performed. What is the process to have the audit reopened to show the expenses?
So I think the easiest way of doing that is filing an offer and compromise doubt as to liability. And so you complete a form 656L. You don't have to do the 433 AOIC. And I would include the proof that you have the expenses, the proof you have of the expenses. Like, and remember, proof of expenses are always two documents, some kind of statement or invoice, bill, and a cancel check or bank statement or something showing that that bill or statement has actually been paid. And you could do it. You can do it that way.
All right. Moving on to, I think we have time for one more, Norman. This is coming from Jessica. Jessica's asking, a client of mine has racked up several years of tax liability, approximately $220,000. Based on a projection I did, he will likely owe for 2018 another $50,000. An NIL has been issued in November. What can I do to delay collection activity long enough to file the tax return? We don't want to have a default on installment agreement if I set it up now.
Okay, so first of all, I would prepare that 2018 return as quickly as you can. So I think it's not too early. The IRS is accepting returns now.
Correct.
And so I would prepare that return as soon as possible. the thing about the NIL, if it was issued 11/20 and it probably gave them 30 days, and that the government was shut down when it became due, and so they're going to come to it right away, you could call and say that the taxpayer is attempting to borrow the money and that they're going to be able to full pay in 90 days, and they may give you time to try to come up with the funds to full pay. And then in the meantime, he files the 2018 return, and now he owes too much, and that loan or whatever he was going to get to pay it off in full didn't go through. And now you prepare a financial statement and you're going to pay what he owes plus 2018. And remember, the first estimated payment for 2019 is due April 15th. So you want to make sure that he makes estimated payments for 19 so he doesn't owe for 19. Or if he's a W-2, that he's adjust his withholding so he's not under withholding. But whatever you do, you want to make sure that he's not going to owe again for 2019.
They're also broaching RO territory there, so they might buy them additional time too.
Yeah, right. So I don't know how much of that is tax or how much is penalties and interest, but with the additional liability, he may owe more, yeah.
Yeah, the 220 plus the 50, he might request at that point when they return, you know, if they need more time.
Right.
All right, guys. Well, I appreciate everyone submitting the question. Apologies to those that are online that I did not get a chance to answer your questions. Some of them that you did submit online are tax-related questions, so we didn't have one of those available now, but I will save the questions, try to get it answered. Again, if it's something that you need answered immediately, if you're not already a VIP member and you can use your consultation time, sign up. Again, it's a 2-month free trial. We're more than happy to schedule a call with one of our professionals to help you address these questions. Again, our next call is going to be March 5th. March 5th is our next practitioners forum call. And Claire, I did see on here that you're asking about replaying these events. In the follow-up email that we sent afterwards, you do get a link to our website once we've uploaded the recording of today's forum call. So you are able to replay these, and we have the library that has them going back to more than a year. So you are able to listen to many of these at a time if you want to just go ahead and pick up additional pointers on how to deal with these resolution cases. So again, thank you everyone for joining us. We look forward to having you attend next month, March 5th. And hope everyone has a great start to this tax season. Good luck, and we will talk to you soon. Goodbye.